Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. What happened in Baltimore this week was nowhere near as extensive, destructive, or deadly as the 4 days and nights of civil unrest that ripped through the city after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. in 1968. The toll then included 6 dead, more than 700 people injured, more than 5,000 people arrested, 1,000 businesses looted, vandalized, or burned, tens of millions of dollars in damage. This week's toll, while heartbreaking, will not approach that. Yet when we talked with Tommy D'Alessandro III last night, who was 3 months into his term as Baltimore City Mayor when the riots erupted in 1968, he saw some connections.
And this is another smear on our reputation. And the question is, how many times can you go through this? Because the riots caused a tremendous amount of expense as far as damage is concerned. The buildings that have to be raised or put on fire, and businesses that are in operations. And then you have the businesses who are no longer in service, like neighborhood grocery stores, pharmacies, and anything like that, which close up a neighborhood. People need these activities to make the neighborhood work, but they're shut down now.
To help us review what we learned from the events of 46 years ago and what we can learn from this week, we ask lawyer, historian, political consultant Larry Gibson to join us. He's a professor at the University of Maryland Law School, author of the biography Young Thurgood, and architect of dozens of successful campaigns for Democratic candidates. And Larry Gibson is with me in the studio. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Baltimore.
Yes.
You were a year out of Columbia Law School, clerking for one of the state's biggest law firms when the riots broke out. What impact did they have on you?
I very much remember the riots. I was living at Sutton Place, so I was close to the National, to the 5th Regiment Armory. And there is just no comparison between that tumultuous event and what happened here early this week. We're talking 1968, about whole sections of the city up in flames and thousands of arrests and all. And so the comparisons are pretty minuscule. We're all embarrassed and chagrined about what happened here earlier this week, but the scale is different, very much so. There are some other things about this more recent matter. While we are, well, certainly everybody who committed a crime, who's apprehended, should be prosecuted, and again, we're all embarrassed as a city for this. But at the same time, there's some lessons being learned that maybe Baltimore is teaching the rest of the nation. I don't recall when I have seen this unanimity between law enforcement and other leaders in a community in dealing with a crisis of this sort. I'm speaking of ministers, community-based leaders, young people, politicians, all working together with the police. And the only bad guys here are the people committing offenses. And I've tried to think about why that is so. And I think it's because the lesson that apparently has been learned that law enforcement people function best when they are not the ones who escalate to the use of deadly violence. In spite of everything that has happened here, it's remarkable that, you know, there have been no shots fired, no one has been killed, because when bullets start to fly, then there gets to be recrimination back and forth, and a division develops between the community and the police. That has not happened here. It was remarkable the way those religious leaders came up, joined the police and the Nation of Islam and others intervened. And ultimately, the solution of this, we all saw on television, that mother who went out and grabbed her son and whipped him in the head as she drug him
viral, yeah.
In a way. I mean, this will never be solved by by police. The city is too big. There are too many streets. There are too many alleys. Eventually, it gets down to individual responsibility, with law enforcement dealing with examples of law breaking. But I think this coalescence of the community and the police is as a result of the mayor and the police commissioner tactically deciding that the police would not escalate the violence, but would try to control and de-escalate. I think they should be commended for that.
Former Mayor D'Alessandro told us that one of the big differences over the 46 years is the training of police and firefighters.
In 1968, we had no experienced policemen in the sense that they had experience in dealing with a riot. They dealt with crime as they knew it. Patrolling the streets in a riot is altogether different. And the same holds true for the firefighter. Firefighters were being stoned and answering to fires. Today, we hope when they come to the house that they got the water on and they could put the fire out, but not with the people throwing stones at them.
Larry Gibson, you're saying that there's a great partnership we're seeing between elected officials and the police. But if the protesters, you said the only bad guys are those committing offenses, but the protesters say the police are bad guys. They say the police are brutal.
But the police did not, as this was going on, exacerbate the situation. They did not escalate the violence. Too many of the examples of persons being killed are situations where the police escalated a situation and made it a violent situation. A man selling cigarettes outside of a store, that ends up with a death. A struggle that's a fist fight between a police and an individual ends up with someone being shot. But this is, and this matter of understanding that the law enforcement people who have superior power, they have weapons, have a responsibility to try to de-escalate and not necessarily use their firepower is important. And this is an ongoing matter. I'm looking at a photograph. This is radio, so you can't see it. Taken in the year that I was born, which is 1942. In 1942, 2,000 Baltimoreans went to Annapolis complaining about police brutality in Baltimore. This specific event, there had been several, but was a situation where there was a fight between a policeman and a man had recently gotten out of the army, and as the man was running away, the policeman shot him in the back and killed him. That's 1942. But then at the center of this is Juanita Jackson Mitchell. And in the photograph, you see the chamber of the House of Delegates filled with people, including some legislators. Just to show you how things continue as a problem, this other photograph I'm showing you that can't be seen by the audience is a photograph of Juanita Mitchell in front of the Weston Police District. This picture was taken in 1959. She's holding her sign, complaining and demonstrating against police brutality. That involved a situation where a police dog had bitten a man and a woman, and they had stained 117 inches. My point is this, that this has been a problem, but it seems that we are starting to learn. That law enforcement persons have an obligation to try to de-escalate a situation and to not use deadly force when it's not necessary to do so. Because if deadly force had been used last Monday, you would not have the kind of cooperation that you're getting up and down the line in the community. There would have been recrimination and accusations back and forth. Instead, you have the political leaders, the religious leaders, the community leaders, and according to the press, even some of the gang leaders working together to control those unruly and unlawful young people who are committing crimes.
That's law professor, historian, and Democratic strategist Larry Gibson here on WIPR Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about this week's unrest in Baltimore. We heard this morning protesters told NPR Steve Inskeep that the Freddie Gray case and relations with the police in general are not, they said, about race. It's about class. It's about poor people being disrespected.
This demonstration in front of the Western District that Juanita Mitchell is camp was one involved. The Western District, which had a African-American captain at that time, and a large percentage of the leaders, they were African-Americans. This demonstration led to some arrests. About 12 of the demonstrators were arrested and then accused by the police, quite falsely, of rioting and attempting to riot, of storming the police station. I represented the persons in the trial came up in 1970. And I knew that what the officers were saying was not true because they were observers, and there was an observer from the Human Relations Commission who had written a report. But what was decisive in my winning the case was in the middle of the trial, a cameraman from a television station came to me and says, "Mr. Gibson, what those police officers are saying is not true. There was not a tumultuous crowd. Nobody threw anything. And in fact, the demonstrators were on the other side of the street." And he says, "Not only that, I filmed it, and there's film to prove it." I went to the television station, got the film, reproduced it, and showed it in court. And it showed that the officers had not been testifying truthfully and that it had been a peaceful demonstration. In fact, it was my introduction to the value of film when dealing with certain kind of matters, particularly when dealing with police community disputes. And so that was 1970.
I'm sure there are people listening to you saying he's proving the case that, as President Obama said this week, this has been going on for a long time and we haven't fixed it. I mean, you seem to be saying, okay, we're turning a corner, but others might listen to your memories and say, we keep screwing this up.
Well, what I think we're doing is turning the corner, at least some places, and certainly it appears here in Baltimore, of governmental officials and law enforcement officials understanding that the police themselves should not escalate the violence. If something is not violent, they should not make it violent. If they should not start shooting and doing things that produce dead people, because that itself then adds new levels of controversy. I'm not saying that we've ended all police overreaction, but we here in Baltimore, I think the mayor and the police commissioner is showing how that you can control and defuse a potentially explosive situation by using less violence than necessary.
We have just about a minute left, and I want to hear one more thing that Mayor D'Alessandro told me about what he's worried about with the economic impact.
You know what I'm concerned about is how the image that Baltimore is portraying now is going to be shared or be a concern of people that we are trying to entice to come to Baltimore for conventions or for big business to locate a home office in Baltimore. And these riots are killing us in that respect. Killing us.
You know the city well.
Sure. First of all, this was not a riot. And what this is, Baltimore showing other cities how to deal with a potentially explosive situation, stopping it from exploding. Yes, there were young people who committed crimes. They should be apprehended. They should be prosecuted. But you had police that did not overreact. Nobody's been killed. And the situation is pretty much under control.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Larry Gibson is a professor at the University of Maryland Law School, a Democratic political advisor, and author of the biography Young Thurgood about Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall's early years. More information on our website, WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Cast. Ahead, how three teenagers see the situation. Stay with us on 88.1.